Okay, Harry Potter fans, welcome back to Chatty Potter. Today, I'm very excited to speak to my friend Conrad for the second time on this podcast. For those of you who don't know, Conrad put together the huge, very, very brilliant Harry Potter fan film entitled Mudblood, which came out in three parts across 2021. If you haven't seen it, you should definitely check it out. It's excellent. Today, we talk all about his fan films, how they came to be, the process, and other projects he's got coming along. Definitely worth listening to if you like fan fiction, fan films, and the extended fanon. Really quickly before we jump in, you can support the podcast on Patreon, patreon.com/chattypotter. It's only £5 a month for all our extra content over there. Plus, it helps support the podcast and make each episode better than the last. So, patreon.com/chattypotter if you'd like to support us. If not, enjoy the episode. Conrad, thank you so much for joining me for the second time on Chatty Potter. Do you want to introduce yourself to anyone who maybe didn't listen to the first episode? Tell us what you do on the internet.
Of course. Well, thank you, Brett, for having me on your wonderful podcast. It's always a great treat talking to you. For those of you who don't know, my name is Conrad Farah, and I am a filmmaker from the United States, from Cleveland, Ohio, to be specific. And in the last year and a half, I made a series of Harry Potter fan films called Mudblood, which is an original story that takes place in the wizarding world, which revolves around a muggle-born witch named Muriel Warrington as she kind of maneuvers her way through America and ends up hanging out with the wrong crowd and ultimately ends up with the possession of something that Voldemort desperately needs or lost. So that's a little bit about me.
Amazing. I love it. I just, like, before we jump into, like, the nitty-gritty of the film and every other thing we want to talk about, Mudblood is such an evocative title, like, for anyone in the Harry Potter space, right? There's so much to it. Was that deliberate? Like, did you deliberately give it something that was maybe a little controversial?
Yeah, that's a great question. Absolutely. Before I even had a story, before I even knew what I wanted to do, I knew that if I were to make a Harry Potter fan film, it was going to be called Mudblood, because
really?
It would be so controversial. People would be like so drawn to it, I feel like. And, you know, and in the real world, it's not a real slur. I mean, if you can, you know, differentiate the real world from the Harry Potter universe, you know, it's just a word. Mm-hmm. And even in the last Harry Potter book in Deathly Hallows, even Hermione owns up to the words, you know, saying I'm a mudblood and proud, which I kind of stole that line from my project. I immediately knew that I wanted it to be a controversial title. And even in social media, some of the comments have been really like kind of harsh, like how dare you use that word as your title?
Really?
Yeah, people get really defensive, and then other people argue with them like, hey, but it's not real life, it's just a movie, like what are you talking about? So it creates conversation. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the early things that I knew that I wanted to do was to call the project Mudblood.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think it feels like it's named in the same tone as a lot of the themes through the film as well, right? It doesn't feel off base, deliberately controversial, but out of place. Like it feels so like bang on what it should be, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's one of the things that I wanted to do. I wanted it to be seamless, you know, with the story that we were trying to tell,
which it absolutely is. So for anyone who's listening who hasn't watched it, first of all, you need to go and watch it. Like, it's such a great feat for a fan film. Like, there are some great fan films out there. There are some not so good fan films out there as well. This is one of the best ones that I've seen, and I'm not just saying that because I see us as friends or because you're on the podcast. I genuinely think it's great. Do you want to give us like an elevator pitch or a synopsis of the whole thing for anyone who's maybe not seen it?
Yeah. This podcast, it's going to be a spoiler podcast for sure, but this synopsis will be a spoiler free. So if anyone hasn't seen the movies, go watch them now, come back and finish the rest of the podcast. Cause I do intend to talk about spoilers finally now that I can talk about it. So basically the movie revolves around this, you know, young witch named Muriel Warrington, who's 16 years old. And she is going to Hogwarts, as you can see in the second episode. And, you know, she kind of actually starts out in her fourth year at Hogwarts during episode two. And then she does something kind of unforgivable to another student, which prompts her to run away to America, where she gets involved with three dark witches known as the Sisters, who were apprentices of Bellatrix Lestrange. And then Muriel Warrington, the main character, starts to become sort of like a Death Eater. And things kind of get out of hand and escalate. And ultimately, she gets put in a life or death situation. And then she has to kind of escape through escape from these kind of Death Eaters all over North America, and it becomes this huge battle, which ends and concludes in this massive epic battle in episode 3. So
massive and epic is absolutely the right word for it as well. It turned out so well, and we'll I guess we'll deep dive each individual part as we go along.
Sure.
I wanted to ask, like, did you have the whole thing planned out before you started episode 1, or did you start episode 1, see how it went, and then write episode 2 and episode 3? Like, how did that writing process go for you?
Oh, another great question. So right off the bat, yes, I had all three in mind from the very beginning. So when I wrote the story, I wrote it kind of in completion. There were, you know, things here and there that changed slightly that I had to adapt to. But for the most part, from the very beginning, I knew all the plot points. I knew from the very, very beginning that it was going to be a story of how Bellatrix Lestrange gets the Hufflepuff cup. That I knew from the very beginning. And I was going to hint at it at the end of episode 1. But to me, like, it always ended with Bellatrix. To me, Bertha was always a villain. So I was very careful when I was writing part 1. I mean, and even part 2, I knew that part 1 and part 2 were so interconnected with the whole time travel thing. And I knew that I wanted to bring that back in part 3 in a much, much clever way for a bigger payoff. So, I mean, everything was kind of interconnected. And it's funny because, like, not even the cast knew about it. Like, we did part 1. They had questions. Like, how does it end? Like, how, you know, how are you doing? Like, they had no idea. So when they started connecting the dots, you know, like, I was getting real time reactions from the cast, and that's how I knew, oh, this is gonna work, or maybe this isn't gonna work. And like always, you know, there's sequences that I had to cut out that weren't in my within my means and my budget. I knew that part 1 was always gonna be a test run. So when I wrote part 1, it was very constrained, because I knew that I didn't have the budget. I didn't know my capabilities, really, as to how much I could even do myself. It wasn't until at the end of part 2 that I said, okay, I know my strengths and weaknesses. Part 3 is the exact movie I always wanted to make. So then it was like, you know, I was free to do whatever I wanted in part 3 at that point. And part 1 also, you introduce the characters. It's almost like a pilot episode of a TV show. You just introduce characters. Part 2, we just deep dived more into the characters, and we kind of set up what I always wanted to do, which was part 3, which is why it's the longest one, and it was the most difficult one. And at that point, thankfully, I had enough means to make it happen. And yeah, and it is what it is now.
It's that, I mean, there's so much that you mentioned that I want to deep dive, and we'll end up running out of time if I keep going on tangents. But first of all, the fact that you got authentic reactions from your cast on these plot points must have been so interesting and rewarding to you as the writer, right?
Oh, it was great, you know, because people, I feel like, overlook the writing sometimes because they're so into the character, maybe the cinematography or the costumes, whatever it is, or the effects. But the writing to me is, it's always the most fun part, because it's really when you craft the story, when you get real reactions from people reading it. And yeah, I mean, there were moments when people read the script that were like, oh, wow, you know, I had no idea this happened or that happened. Or like in episode 2 that, you know, the Jack was going to come back and he was going to be kind of like the guy that got his mind erased at the end of part 1. I mean, just things like that, you know, getting reactions was just always so fun.
Things like that as well, those twists that you threw in there, like, so rewarding, like,
yeah,
very well written, well done. I have this thing where my compliments sound sarcastic. I'm genuine, that was sincere. I'm sorry if it didn't come across. So you touched on there about how people maybe get sidetracked sometimes with, like, with the maybe the visual effects or whatever. I find in, like, fan films especially, there's a lot of fan service. People get, like, pulled in by, we're back in this world, and maybe the stories don't necessarily have to measure up. Whereas I found with yours, with so many original characters and with their backstories and their nuances, like, how hard was it for you to interweave all these original concepts for characters and have them with backstories in such a short space of time?
Yeah, so I originally wrote like a Bible for each character. Like, I wrote strengths and weaknesses for each character. I wrote where they're coming from. I wrote who, you know, their dad and mom was. I wrote everything. So I wanted to, before I write the story, I wanted to write the characters to see if they could inhabit the world. And then little by little, I mean, I started enhancing the characters. I mean, I knew where the story was going, but after doing part 1, and I knew the actors, I said, oh, well, this guy has this mannerism here. It would be kind of cool. So sometimes I started adapting things just based on the characters that I had already known from part 1. So even though I knew the story, And I knew everything, you know. In part two, I enhanced it based on some of the actors.
Sure.
And yeah, I mean, it was really interesting to kind of tie everything together, because you do have such a finite amount of time to make it all happen. You know, and as far as like fan service, I feel like every fan film obviously has to service their fans. So, I mean, mm-hmm. we did sprinkle that throughout as much as we could, even in subtle lines. Like even in part three, there's like a line that Merlin says, you know, there will be others that will find that cup and they will succeed, you know, as an homage to the Golden Trio. You know, so there's just little moments like that. But, you know, the fun thing for me was really at the beginning, establish that character Bible. And I would always go back to that character Bible. Would this be something that Muriel would do? Would this be something that, you know, that Merlin would do? Would the sisters do this? Would Emmeline do this? And it was a great reference point, and it always kind of kept me on track.
Mm-hmm. I think we last spoke about 8 months ago, but I think you mentioned that you wrote fan fiction before you got into like screenplays. Is that sort of the similar way that you'd approach your like fanfics and stuff?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So I started out, I mean, before I even made movies, I wrote fan fiction, Harry Potter fan fiction. So yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, when I was doing those, I was establishing the characters, even though at that point I was so young that I was putting myself as the main character. So it was all my character traits and all my friends' character traits within the wizarding world, which made it super easy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's the same thing with filmmaking and with storytelling as far as the screenplay is concerned. You start out by writing and knowing your characters and then diving into what the story is going to be. I knew how the story was going to end, and I knew how it was going to begin. So like the two things that I knew right off the bat was it starts out in a creepy house with this girl running away from three witches. That's mm-hmm. all I knew from the beginning. I didn't know anything else at that point. I knew that beginning, and I knew at the end Bellatrix gets the cup from the bad guys and kills them. Like that's something that I knew. And then it's like, okay, what happens in the middle? I don't know what's episode two, what's all of episode one. So I started kind of going like backwards, you know? So how do we get to that ending point from that beginning point? Like what would be cool scenes that I want to watch? And then sometimes I would think of a really cool scene and I don't know where to put that scene, but then I would come up with another scene and I'm like, oh, well, this one would tie in with this other scene if we do this. Mm-hmm. And that's how I started piecing everything together, you know, little by little.
Oh my God. It sounds, to someone who's never written anything to completion before, it sounds like such a journey, an adventure. Like it sounds like a massive feat to get it all down on paper.
It was an emotional journey, to be honest with you, to a point that even episode one, I wrote rather quickly, to be honest with you. And episode two took a little bit more time. I'd say episode two was the most fun because mm-hmm. I did write some Hogwarts moments into it. And I wish I could have made those a little bit bigger. But then episode three, which was, there was so much expectation now that we got people from one and two. People had already seen one and two. There was so much expectation for part three. And I was writing three while I finished episode one. Like I was already writing three, like so early on. It took like half a year to write just episode three.
Oh, wow.
Which is a very, very long time for me.
Yeah. And I guess talking about writing then, I know we have listeners who have probably written fan fiction, maybe want to get into like filmmaking or whatever. Sure. Any tips on how to write something as complete and whole as Mudblood?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to do is just, you know, not be afraid of the blank page, because I think that's always what intimidated me, was seeing this blank screen and thinking, oh my God, like, you know, that's such a journey ahead. How do you even start? And sometimes you don't have to start at the beginning, start in the middle. I mean, sometimes that's what helps me, is starting in the middle. I mean, look at Star Wars Episode 4, the original New Hope. That kind of started like in the middle of a story. Then they went back to tell the rest of the story. So to me, that's kind of how I started it. I mean, I said, I'm going to put this witch in the middle of a crazy house being haunted by other witches, and no one's going to know what's happening, but it's going to be really cool. And then we're going to peel the layers. Then we're going to slowly reveal. Don't always give away your characters. Don't always give away your story. Make the audience slowly find out, which makes the journey a lot more interesting and a lot more rewarding at the end.
Yeah, and it's definitely something that I really enjoyed about your sort of set of three stories, or one continuous story in three parts. Mm-hmm. The flashbacks and the gradual reveals of like motivations and why people are doing what they're doing and ended up where they are. Sure. So rewarding, because I guess at that point you're already invested, as opposed to, like you say, starting from the beginning. It's showing rather than telling, right?
Absolutely. And I love a good, I'd love to show people. I'm a visual learner. So I, you know, I try to explain things visually to people. And that's the same thing with film to me.
Yeah.
And I learned that, you know, from like early on, like the movies that I loved were told kind of out of order, like, you know, growing up watching Pulp Fiction and seeing everything tangled together or even the show Mad Men, to be honest with you, it was a very popular show, you know, many, many years ago. And Mad Men, you know, you had this really great main character. And then later you start to realize, oh, that's not his real name. Oh, he's got like a different girl here. Oh, he's got a different family. Like you start seeing all these things about this guy that you thought you knew. Mm-hmm. To me, that was like the greatest lesson in storytelling. I was like, oh my God, I could do anything with a story kind of like that. You know, kind of build trust with your characters and then you start really pulling at the heartstrings of the audience.
So. I love that. And talking of pulling at the heartstrings and fan service, which we've touched on, the Bellatrix scenes at the end of part three.
Yes. Yes.
How did they come up? Was that, I know you said you always wanted Bellatrix to end with the cup, but did you always know you were going to have her physically in the movie?
Yes. Yes. I knew that I was going to have Bellatrix physically at the end of part three. I did. And that's honestly the one thing that kept haunting me throughout the series was, who's going to play Bellatrix? How are we going to dress Bellatrix? How is how is any of this going to happen? And I knew what the scene was, even from part one. I knew the scene was she's going to be like hell-bent, angry Bellatrix that's just going to, you know, destroy the sisters. I wanted it to be the Darth Vader scene in Rogue One, essentially. See him just wrecking everyone, like, you know, with one move. Like, I wanted Bellatrix to be so OP that it would be such a huge moment in the movie. And thankfully,
you delivered, absolutely.
Oh, thank you. We found this incredible actress. I found her on TikTok,
really?
Darby McNeil, and she is so wonderful to work with. We found her out of Chicago. We had auditions for Bellatrix, and no one was really hitting in the nail. And people, you know, there was just something missing from every audition that we got. And then I found Darby, who was a professional Bellatrix cosplayer. And I said, well, I wonder if she can act. So I had her audition and she nailed it. She was incredible. So much so that I later regretted not giving her lines, because when I heard her speak as Bellatrix, I was like, oh my goodness, it's dead on. I should have had her have a couple of lines. I mean, besides just the spells. But yeah, no, it was the moment that we had her walk onto the set, and props to Keri Lewis, who does the Hermione cosplays, who played Hermione in part two.
Yeah.
Her, because she came from Indiana to help costume Darby as Bellatrix. So I had her.
Wow.
So they were in the hotel, like getting her completely ready. So then when they walked into the set, it was like, oh my goodness, this is officially like an actual Harry Potter film. Like, vibe just like was so different at that point, seeing her in full Bellatrix. So it was honestly, that was one of the best sequences, I think, in the whole series and one of my absolute favorites.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. She was perfect. The mannerisms, like the way she came across as Bellatrix, but also like just that moment in the film. Like, I know you said that's what you wanted all the way from the start.
Yeah.
But having her, and we're getting into major spoiler territory here, but having her slaughter the sisters like that,
yeah,
like blew me away. Absolutely, yeah. Like was not expecting it at all.
Oh.
It was so good. Such a great moment.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it's one of my favorites. I mean, I think that one, when people see that one's like, you know, I think it's the moment of part three. It's like it all culminates to seeing Bellatrix, because we talk about her in part one. We mentioned her throughout part two. And then it's like, is she going to show up? Is she not going to show up? A lot of fans predicted that she was.
Really?
And I couldn't let them down. And I knew that she was. I mean, you know, when we were making TikToks or when I would go live, people would be like, oh, is Bellatrix going to show up? Is Bellatrix going to show up? And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know. It was like almost like Spider-Man No Way Home keeping, you know, it's like that was me with Bellatrix. So it was fun.
So worth keeping it quiet as well, I guess, to have that reveal moment, right? The impact you know you will have had.
Yes.
So I guess now that those three parts are wrapped up, what's next, Comrade?
Well, I mean, we're still actively developing more stories that takes place within the wizarding world. I mean, we got a couple of things that are, you know, we have irons in the fire, I should say. They're not concrete, but they're ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And right now I'm getting ready to direct something completely different. So I'm taking a break from the wizarding world right now, and I'm doing a zombie movie.
Oh, nice.
Now, yeah, I wrote it really quickly. I cast it. The crew is ready to go. We have rehearsals all week. We have rehearsals tomorrow. We have rehearsals Thursday. Like all day, every day. I feel like we're going to be rehearsing because we're doing it in a very experimental way. We're doing a lot of really long one takes. Really long.
Oh, wow.
1 minute one takes. Like it's like a play. I feel like that I'm directing. It's a very unique zombie movie. It's a different approach. It's not like your typical zombie movie. It's almost like a love story intertwined with a drama with zombies in the like in the background. So it's really kind of crazy. It's my first project that I'm shooting in anamorphic. So we're renting these massive anamorphic lenses, which for people who don't know, they're very expensive widescreen lenses. So it's gonna be like it's very beautiful, very different than Mudblood, but hopefully the fans who loved the Mudblood series and what we did with that, hopefully they'll get to enjoy this because it's another thrill ride. It's something different, but very, very fun. So I'm excited.
Very cool. Sounds super, super exciting. Is that going to be released on your YouTube channel as well? Or?
Oh, good question. No, so this one will not be on my YouTube. The trailers and stuff will be, but this one we're hoping that will be going on hopefully a streamer. I don't know who yet. I have a couple films on Amazon Prime and things like that. And hopefully this one will have a similar journey. I really hope Hulu picks it up. We're going to be pitching it to a lot of different streamers once it's all said and done, because it is a feature-length project. It is like a 90-minute film. So it's called Before the Leaves Turn Red. Nice. That is the title. And so I'm hoping that, at some point, sometime in the fall or sometime next year, people get to watch the film somewhere. I don't know where, but to enjoy it.
How are you feeling about, like, pitching to streamers? Is it something you've done a lot of? Because it strikes me as a really daunting concept.
Yeah. So basically you need a sales representative for your film. So basically you need someone to represent your movie, like an agent. And the agent goes out and like represents the movie. And the agent goes to Hulu and Netflix and Amazon and all these places and is like, hey, listen, we have this great film here. Would you like to buy it for X amount of dollars or make some kind of deal? And I've never had a movie on Hulu or Netflix or that, but I have had them on a couple other different streamers like Tubi and Vudu and On Demand and Amazon Prime, of course, and iTunes. So I'm really hoping that this one's a little bit bigger, because last time that I had a movie on those platforms, I feel like I wasn't as skilled of a filmmaker.
Sure.
And I feel like doing Mudblood even finessed my skills even more. It was really a wonderful experience. So now I feel very prepared to tackle on something even a little bit bigger. In terms of like the theatrics of it, the drama, the story, it's something original and a little bit bigger in scope as well, with explosions and jets and military trucks. I mean, it's kind of nuts, as it always is, because you always want to up the ante. But I'm really hoping that this one, becomes like a very, very big project. So.
Yeah. Dude, I hope I get to watch it. I hope it gets picked up by something so it comes international. That would be cool.
Yeah.
You said that you think that Mudblood helped you develop as a filmmaker. Is there anything that stands out that you think, okay, this is the biggest thing that I progressed through the project or learned compared to where I was when I started?
Yeah, for sure. So I feel like when you see part one and you compare it to part three, I think you almost see like the transformation in me as a filmmaker. I feel like with part one, and even in part two, I was still playing it safe a little bit. I was still kind of like reserved. I was still learning what I could pull off as a director, even though I have been directing for a very long time. I just feel like this one was more special to me because I'm so in love with the Harry Potter universe.
Sure.
So it felt like I was doing something that I truly just felt so connected to. And then for part three, I felt unhinged. It's like, okay, everyone knows that you're doing Mudblood, go crazy with it, do exactly what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that is exactly what I did. And I feel like if I could think of a way to make it harder on myself, I would do it to challenge myself. And I feel like every time I pushed myself and kept pushing myself, like it somehow ended up being a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like it motivated me to be better. So by the time the climax of part three happened, like I was, first of all, exhausted. I couldn't function. I looked homeless, I feel like, for an entire month and a half. But it was so worth it, Brett. It was so worth it. And I feel like that's the one takeaway, was, being like, knowing how much I could push myself as a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's something that I'm going to, kind of continue on doing with the next couple of projects.
Yeah, like the filmmaking equivalent to leaving it all out in the field, right? Just push yourself to your absolute limit.
Absolutely, yes, definitely.
I love it, I love it. Okay, so ideal world, you get as much funding as you want, a team together tomorrow to shoot whatever the hell you want.
Yeah.
Let's go one Harry Potter thing and one totally separate from the Wizarding World. What sort of projects are you hoping to develop?
Wow. Okay. My goodness. That is. Oh, my goodness. Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to go with my personal one, then I'm going to go in the Wizarding World one. And they would both be fun. So if I was given an unlimited budget, oh, my goodness. I think I would do a film that I wanted to do since I was like 14 years old, which is a science fiction project called Sfoth, which is about this alien humanoid that comes from the Plejaren star system and comes to Earth to prevent World War III. Complete sci-fi. It's kind of like Dune in the way it's aesthetically made. It's very epic, like Star Wars Dune. It's something along those lines. It is also a trilogy. I've had that project in mind all my life, I feel like, and someday I'm hoping to do it, no matter what budget I get or whatever. But I am so drawn to science fiction fantasy, and to me, this Sfoth project is like would be like a dream come true. But I also want to do it right. I want to make it very dramatic, almost like Lord of the Rings. I don't want it to be campy in any way, and I want to be very limiting with how many like visual effects I do. I want them to be very, very powerful. So I feel like that's what I would do. I've been
That
thinking a
sounds
lot about
cool.
that project. So yeah.
Is that something you've written, or it's a book that exists already, did you say?
Oh, that's a great question. Okay, so there is an actual man named Billy Meyer who apparently met this Plejaren man called Sfoth. So I kind of drew in from his story. It's I don't know if it's true or not, to be honest with you. I can't say that for myself, but this man Billy Meyer, he's from, I believe, Switzerland, and he is the first man to ever photograph a quote unquote flying saucer.
Right, okay.
And he's got like all these different photos online, and people call him a hoax and all this stuff. And I mean, there's a lot of controversy around this man, but his story is so fascinating. So what I'm basically doing with Sfoth is taking part of his life, but really making it my own and twisting it around and expanding dramatically on this Plejaren man named Sfoth that he met. Like I'm talking dramatically and adding this World War III element to it to make it this grand epic scope of a science fiction movie. So I mean, I would probably have to get the life rights, to be honest with you, from Billy Meyer. But yeah, no, it would be such a really cool, intense visual project. So
Oh, that sounds very exciting. Yeah, if you had an unlimited budget, it sounds like science fiction
Oh,
fantasy would be such a rewarding place to put it.
absolutely. I mean, give me Dune, the Dune budget, and then I could pull that off for sure. But as far as the Wizarding World, now that's where it gets really interesting because I could do so many things, and I thought about so many projects that I would want to do with the Wizarding World. And I think, I mean, obviously, what everyone wants to see is the Marauders. So I feel like I'm not gonna do it just because everyone. I feel like everyone just wants to do that. Like other filmmakers want to do that, and I've seen a lot of Marauders movies, even on YouTube and whatever. But I feel like I would want to do a serious black movie, like just a movie about
Okay.
serious black. And I might have touched on that a couple months ago when we last talked. But a serious black backstory, just on Sirius Black and how he gets into Azkaban, and then his life in Azkaban in prison with the Dementors, and eventually how he escapes. So I would call it Sirius Black and the Escape from Azkaban. It
Nice.
would be just like a single story about Sirius Black, like living in Azkaban, and obviously then trying to reach Harry and escaping. And that's the one thing that I wish we would have seen in the Harry Potter films is how Sirius escaped. And it's something that we obviously read about in the books, and I just think it would be like the coolest thing ever. It would be just so epic and so dazzling. And then there's another project, Brett, that I was thinking about that I would want to do. And I know for a fact that I can't do this now as a filmmaker because even if I was given like a modest budget, it would still blow my mind. I don't know how to do it. But I want to do a Wizarding World movie about Quidditch, like
Oh, wow, okay.
a sports drama. But just about Quidditch. Like you talk about this Quidditch team wanting to go to the World Cup, and it's almost like the Queen's Gambit, but for Quidditch, and it's about someone like thriving in the sport and then ultimately going to the Quidditch World Cup. And there's no bad guys, there's not no evil or anything. It's just like it's a sports drama, but with Quidditch. And I just think it would be so cool.
Oh my
So
God, I love that. That's like what, like Moneyball, Remember the Titans, like sports as a conduit for the drama.
Yep, exactly. Like the movie Miracle, just something, like I feel like a lot of sports have like very iconic movies, and I would want to do an iconic sports movie in the Wizarding World, like a Quidditch movie. I
Oh my
just think
gosh,
it'd
I'd
be
love
so
that.
different,
That would be so cool. I feel like I've never heard that concept from anyone about like fan fiction or fan films or anything. That would be so good.
Right? Yeah. So Warner Brothers, if you're listening, because I know you're spying on me, Warner Brothers, go. You kind of just want to watch it at this point. So.
Oh my goodness. Yes, absolutely. Also the Sirius Black idea. I love the concept of like an Aronofsky style psychological thriller, yes, focusing on Sirius in Azkaban.
Oh my gosh. Yes, absolutely. You hit it dead on. Like an Aronofsky movie, but with Sirius Black in Azkaban. So gritty, dark, edgy. Mm-hmm.
Love that. Absolutely love that. Going back to the film that you have made then, or one of many films that you've made, sure, the Mudblood series. I think over 1.5 million people have seen it, have seen each of the three parts altogether, plus millions more seeing the behind the scenes stuff on your TikTok, on your Instagram. How does it feel like, I guess as a filmmaker, that's the end goal, right? To share these stories. How does that feel, having it out there and millions of people having seen it?
Oh, it's crazy rewarding. I mean, I remember the first time like we knew that we had something special in our hands was when like the TikToks really started blowing up and getting the millions of views and people like Googling Mudblood, and I saw the spikes in the views on YouTube. And even like a friend of mine who worked on the movie briefly in Montana, which is so far away in the United States, I feel like it's just such an unknown little state. People in Montana, he was like, oh yeah, my coworkers were talking about Mudblood this morning and they had no idea I worked on it. And I was like, are you kidding? And like my sisters who go to school in South Carolina were telling me how all of their friends were watching Mudblood on YouTube that morning. And I'm like, this is crazy. Like everyone's talking about Mudblood. And it was so surreal. Like my actors were getting recognized at like drive-thrus at like Starbucks. And like it was so, so crazy. I mean, even I was getting recognized. And I'm like, I'm barely even on my own like social media. So it was so cool. But it's ultimately so rewarding as a storyteller, because at the end of the day, you make films so people can watch them, so people can enjoy them. And I love that. I love the fact that Mudblood gave me a chance for people to see what I can do as a filmmaker. And also hopefully inspired others to do the same, and others to pick up a camera or to write a novel or to do whatever their creative outlet is, and hopefully put their stuff out there.
Yeah, I'm certain that you have, like, I'm certain that people have been inspired by that to pick up a pen or pursue their passion projects, like, absolutely. Yeah. What's your favorite scene from all three parts?
Oh, my goodness, I knew this was coming. Well, I think, gosh, there's so many. I mean, I had a fun time making all of these films, but I think the one that really stands out that I think is the superior scene that I knew that I wanted to do from the very beginning was, and spoiler alert, obviously, but Muriel yielding two wands and holding off the two sisters with the two wands, with the double wands.
Beautiful.
Something that we never saw in the Harry Potter films. And so much so that I started to think, is that possible? And I went into a deep dive into the books, like, trying to find out where anyone you know had two wands, and then in Deathly Hallows Harry did for a second was like fighting with two wands in the Battle of Hogwarts and Deathly Hallows, and I'm like, okay, great, that's all I needed to know. And then I just went off of that, and you know, and then Muriel with the two wands was such a quick scene, Brett, because we had a massive rainstorm coming on set that day. Like it was
really,
we had maybe 15-20 minutes to do that entire sequence, 20 minutes to do that entire sequence in the middle of those little caves, the ledges.
Oh my
and
word.
We were rushing. So basically I had the camera on McKenna, the actress, and then I had a guy with like a makeshift fan, which wasn't even a fan, it was like a piece of cardboard blowing on her hair. And I had slow motion. I had two other people with like lights on her face. It was like the most bizarre thing. And we had to do it so quickly. We were like running to do that scene. And we pulled it off so quick, so much so that I was on the drive home, I'm like, did I get everything? Like, and then obviously when Patrick, my editor, put it together, I was like, okay, yeah, this is gonna be great. So
it was gorgeous. And that must have been so stressful, by the way, having to rush such a like a scene that is now your favorite.
Yeah.
It felt to me like a Darth Maul moment. You know when Darth Maul first pushes out his lightsaber and then the second side comes out?
Yeah.
It felt like that. It was so
absolutely.
It also felt like that was when I was like, holy shit, the visual effects on this, like when you see the individual particles, when you've got sort of, you've got like a medium close up on her from a slight angle, right over the pointer of the wand.
Right.
When you see all the individual particles like moving around.
Yeah.
Gorgeous. Absolutely beautiful. I want that as a still for my bookshelf behind me.
Oh yeah. Mad props to my visual effects supervisor, Sam Shippers, who did a marvelous job on part three. I think he pushed the envelope from the previous installments. And, you know, I that was one of the scenes that I was so nervous to really see. And I remember when he showed me like the first draft of the visual effects, I was going to cry. I was like, oh, you did it. You pulled it off. You did exactly how we pictured it. And it was just beautiful.
Amazing. Yeah, so good. I guess on the flip side then, in retrospect, if you had one thing you could change now that the whole thing has been put together, is there anything that stands out or...
So in part two, Mudblood part two, I think the beginning at Hogwarts, like the way that it's written is so different than the way that it's filmed. And it's so unfortunate because when we filmed it, like COVID was just raging everywhere. And we were being so precautious of how we were filming. So we couldn't film indoors in such a big, because of so many people. And there was this beautiful location that looked like Hogwarts on the inside. It was the University of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. And it was just incredible. I think I emailed them maybe 10 times to try to get permission. And they said, we would give you permission, but unless the mandates are less strict, we can't do it because of COVID. So then I said, well, I have to move this entire sequence from an indoor to an outdoor location. So when I first conceived the story for the beginning of part two, like I wanted it to be an indoor battle inside like the Great Hall, like something cool as that. Like that's how I wrote it. Wow. And then later I said, well, I have to change it, unfortunately, and try to find somewhere that looks relatively similar to Hogwarts. And yeah, I mean, and that's the one thing that if I could go back, say, in a couple of years from now and like, you know, change, like that would be like the one thing. It would be inside Hogwarts. And then there's sacrifices that I have to do as a filmmaker that I live with now that I'm okay with. Like for part three, like the end of part two, it ends with Alvin running off like into the sky with his broom and everything. And part three, the very first scene was supposed to be a sky battle between all of the characters. Like I was supposed to have them all in brooms fighting in the sky. And I realized very quickly that it would be very, very hard. Like, you know, and I mean, I could have pulled it off, but I feel like it would have looked not like exactly like how I wanted it to. And I feel like it would have cheapened the movie a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I decided to cut it out completely. And I ended up replacing it with the Boggart scene in the woods. So, yeah.
Which was lovely, by the way. I loved that it was, and that Alvin saves Merlin as well. Like, gorgeous scene. Like, I'm sure the sky battle would have been phenomenal as well. Right. But I loved that scene too.
Thank you. It's something that we haven't seen really is, you know, we saw the Boggarts obviously, like, you know, in Prisoner of Azkaban and, you know, but also, always inside like this, like, closet. And I wanted them out in the wild. Like, what would they look like in the wild, like in the woods and spread out? And I thought that would be just a really cool thing to see that we haven't seen.
And they, correct me if I'm wrong, they were like weaponized by the sisters, right?
They were.
Like that, 100%. Such a out of left field, but it sounds like it's exactly what people would do, I feel like, if a creature like that existed.
Exactly. I mean, they did the same thing with the Dementors. I feel like you just kind of turn them to the, you know, to like the bad side. And, you know, yeah, I loved, you know, when I included the Boggarts, I mean, that's something that I wasn't expecting. So like when I wrote the story from the very beginning, I didn't think of that scene. That scene did not exist until part three happened. So that's one of those examples where it just kind of developed.
Mm-hmm. I loved it. It was so good. Do you have a favorite character from your series?
Oh,
and,
wow.
And remove the actors from it. I'm not asking you for your favorite person from your cast, but your favorite character that you wrote.
Sure. Well, I guess it's a tie. As far as characters, I really loved Muriel because I feel like she is that hero. And I feel like I just spent so much time perfecting her. It's like, you know, she's my main character. And like, I just spent so much time figuring out who she was on paper. And then seeing her be this really cool hero was just such a great moment. But then I also have this soft spot for Emmeline, because Emmeline was that redeeming character that I knew in part three wasn't going to be all evil. Like I knew that there was this heart to her that we see at the beginning of part three. And her arc was always so intriguing to me. And I wrote her arc way beforehand. In fact, I wrote the arc for all three sisters. I just didn't have the money or time to explore all three sisters and how they turn. But I knew that we could explore at least one of them. So I think Emmeline and Muriel were certainly my two favorites.
Mm-hmm.
What about you, Brett? Well, who was your favorite?
You know what? I loved Merlin. I thought it was such a great character. Also, like, it was almost like cheeky with the time travel. It was almost a bit like, I know I shouldn't really be doing this. Like, I loved that sort of almost arrogance to the way he, like, he came through like with his arc.
Right.
Loved that character.
I love writing Merlin as well. Like you said, it was very cheeky. He's just kind of like, you know, he knows that he can do that kind of stuff because of how powerful he is. Love that character.
Amazing. I did want to ask from a technical perspective, and by all means, tell me to mind my own business. A project like this, what's the total budget for all three parts look like to put something like this together?
Yeah, I think you asked me this like months ago, and I'm like, oh, I don't know if I can say it. And now it's like, whatever. Like, I'll tell you everything you need to know.
Oh, sorry, I didn't realize I was doubling down. I don't mean to put pressure on you.
It's good because now I can talk about it. I think beforehand I couldn't talk about it because I didn't want to like mess up the next couple of like you know, I didn't want anyone really knowing. Mm-hmm. And messing up with the producers. But all three in total was about $35,000.
You know, I was expecting it to be way higher than that. Like, really? I mean, it looks like a much more expensive project. Clearly, you've done a fantastic job with your budget. Yeah, but I was expecting to be pushing like six figures.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, no. Like pushing up to 100 grand or so. Like,
yeah, no, it was about
so interesting.
35. So it was like 10,000 for part one, 10,000 for part two, and then part three was about $15,000.
Wow.
So
good job, dude. That's so impressive to turn around with that budget.
Yeah, and thankfully, so many Harry Potter fans donated and wanted to come in. Like part three, I had so many fans that were following the series want to produce, and that's how we got the budget even higher. So that's when I knew that I could go crazy for part three. So thankfully I had such a great support system, and even in part two, like all the fans, like we had a good amount of fans donate as well, which was just so fantastic.
So. Amazing. Well, look, it turned out great. You did such a good job. All of your cast and crew did as well. I'm so excited to have got to talk to you about it after it wrapped as well, like to talk about it as a whole.
Sure. We have closure now on the series.
Exactly. And if you do make another Harry Potter project, you're going to have to come on the podcast for a third time and like plug
it. Absolutely. I mean, I have a couple of things that I might be working on. I just don't know if they're going to come to fruition. I hope that they do, but those would be wild. Those would be really, really cool projects.
Nice. Well, if you need a charismatic British person to make a cameo in any of them, absolutely up for it.
Of course.
Before we finish, I do still have this tradition of asking people what I think are relatively interesting or controversial conversation starters. So I just got a couple of questions I want to ask you.
Yes, please.
First one, you can get a magic tattoo that moves like the portraits and stuff move in the Harry Potter universe. What tattoo are you going for? I didn't ask you this one last time, did I?
No, you did not.
Okay, good.
Interesting. So a tattoo that like moves like a, oh, wow. Okay. You always leave the hardest questions for the end. I love it.
Got to keep that listener retention, right? All the way to the end.
Yeah. You know, I'm really drawn to the moon. And I know a lot of my friends are as well. And I just have always had this fascination since I was a little boy of just loving the moon, especially the full moon. So I feel like I would have all the moon cycles kind of cycling as a tattoo. I think that would be really, really cool to see. Honestly.
Like in real time as the moon cycles actually occur.
Yeah. Well, maybe. Actually, that would be even better. Yeah. It's like, okay, is it a full moon out today? Oh, it looks like it is. You know, that would be so convenient. That would be really cool. Yeah.
I love that. That's so cool. Next question is specifically for you. I won't ask any other guest this.
Oh, okay.
But if you could pick three actors for your next project of any actor in the world, in history, alive or dead, which three actors would you want to work with for your next project? And to be nice, you have to kind of pick actors you'd work with before, so we take them off the table. Brand new actors you've never worked with.
Brand new actors?
Yeah.
Three of them. Oh my goodness. Okay. I feel like I should know this answer, but I don't. I feel like you, Brett, of course, have to be one of them. I'm going to give you one of the slots.
Absolutely. I wouldn't consider myself an actor, but I'll take it.
Hey, you could do it. And then you said alive or dead, right? So, okay. Vivian Leigh, the great Vivian Leigh from Gone with the Wind. I mean, she's just a class actress from like the 30s, 40s, 50s, just golden age actress. I feel like, you know, having a chance to have worked with her would have been such a dream because she's such an iconic presence on screen. So Vivian Leigh would have probably been one of them. And, oh man, I want to say James Stewart. the great James Stewart. It's a Wonderful Life, and you know, all these classics, and Rear Window. Gosh, I just picked dead people. I mean, I guess you'll get all dead people, Brett, with this new cast. But I just feel like you know, James Stewart, Vivien Leigh, and obviously you, Brett. I think that's a hell of a cast right there. That's an Academy.
Oh my gosh, yes. Put us in it. I'm trying to think of what on earth the three of us could bring together, what kind of project it would be.
What about you? Tell me who you would want your co-stars to be, alive or dead.
Ooh. I am in awe of Philip Seymour Hoffman's ability to morph into any character. Yes. Like, I'd love Philip Seymour Hoffman in just any more projects. Like, I think that would be great. Who else? You know what? Domhnall Gleeson was Bill Weasley. Like, I think he's such a great, subtle actor.
Fantastic actor.
Brilliant. I'd love to see him. I'd love to just watch him act. If I was at a project with him, I'd just watch him. I don't think I'd get any acting.
Yeah, it's like how you're being all like, oh, you're so great. You're so great.
Right.
He's fantastic. I love him.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Okay, final question.
Yeah.
You get to take Felix Felicis and go back to any day in your life and live it with perfect luck.
Oh.
Which day do you pick?
Oh my God, with perfect luck. Oh, any day of my life. Oh my gosh, that's another fantastic question.
Thank you.
Wow. Okay. Any day of my life with fantastic luck. I feel like I'm going to keep it Mudblood related because I feel like that's been our theme tonight. Mm-hmm. So Mudblood Part 3 was the only... it was the only film out of the three that we had a lot of weather constraints. Like, you have no idea how many times I had to cancel a shoot, and I don't cancel shoots. I'm the kind of person that goes like, if it's raining, that's film. If it's snowing, that's film. But this one, it was like massive storms that we just could not film through. So I feel like I would use Felix Felicis to, you know, have the rain go away, like perfectly film the sequences that we, you know, at least the one that I had planned where it just completely got rained out. We had to like completely just shut down. Mm-hmm. That was one of the most heartbreaking days because I felt myself losing the schedule and people were starting to get a little bit impatient because our schedule was just like, was going all over the place because of all these weather delays. So if I could go back, I'd be like, weather, cooperate, and everything would go swimmingly and with perfect luck. So.
That's a great answer. That's very fitting as well. You're right, for the things we've talked about today. Thank you so much for talking to me about Mudblood. I'm so excited to see anything else you make. Is there anything you want to plug, anything you've got going on at the moment that the listeners should check out?
Well, it was great. You know, first of all, it was great talking to you as well, Brett. You know, I always have a lovely time chatting with you, and this is like literally one of my favorite podcasts. So this is just fantastic.
Thank you.
And I guess, you know, just keep a lookout for the next project, you know, which is Before the Leaves Turn Red, my zombie project that I'm, you know, going to be doing. It's on the Conrad Studios YouTube channel. We're going to be posting updates in the next couple of weeks. Oh, and also something that I haven't told anyone, this could be an exclusive, and it's Mudblood related. Ooh. This is like brand new that I can, I guess, tell everyone about. While filming Mudblood Part 3, my friend Brad Smolinski filmed an entire feature documentary over the making of Mudblood Part 3. You're going to see me and the cast like full on like experiencing the entire adventure of making the entire third episode. And it's like, it's, you see everything. You see the frustration, you see the good moments, you see the happiness, you see the fun little, you know, back and forth between the actors, the rehearsals, the everything. I mean, I had no idea where the cameras were half the time. Like when I was watching some of the footage, I was like, how are you filming that moment? Like, this is crazy. I feel like my privacy was invaded, but it's great because I got to see myself from an outsider's perspective. And then ultimately it leads to the premiere that we had, a local premiere where we, you know, sold out two screens. And it's a really cool documentary. I don't know when it's going to be coming out. We're still finishing it up, but it's going to be awesome. And everyone who watched Mudblood can get to experience what it was like to make one of them. Which is the third one, the hardest one. So.
Uh-huh. Oh, you know what? That makes sense, actually, because you've posted loads of back behind the scenes stuff on your socials, right? So it makes sense that there was a lot of filming going on, like behind the scenes of it. I can't wait to see that, especially since you've said you can see the life leave your eyes as things get rained off. Like, I want to see that moment in 4K.
My gosh. Oh, absolutely. And you're going to see a lot of people talk about, here's the weather. And we like see us with the radar for like the weather, like in so many like sequences, like it's really cool. And nothing that we filmed from the behind the scenes has been seen on my social media. So even though we have shared a lot on social media, none of it has been seen on social media. So it's all brand new footage, which is
nice.
Going to be really, really cool. We kept it a secret. So there's one more big secret from Mudblood that we haven't shared. So I'm excited for people to see that.
Dude, I can't wait to watch it.